afternoon. This is Charles Pace, Executive Director of the Gwinnett County Public Library, and I'm here with David Baker, Fundraising Consultant for Giving Design. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Charles. Excited to be here.
So we're going to go through a few questions, David. Just thought I'd ask you a little bit about fundraising and some of the experiences you've had and perhaps some tips and clues for people that are maybe interested in starting fundraising for their library or other nonprofit organization. So to start with, if we could, just tell me a little bit about how you first got into fundraising for libraries to begin with.
Let's see. Well, back in, I think it was probably 2001, so not too far after 9/11, actually, I was working with a fundraising firm who about half their business was public libraries across the country, and ended up helping some consultants on projects in Bentonville, Arkansas, and Grosse Pointe, Michigan, and some other places, and really started, it had already been something I enjoyed personally, and to add that sort of professional piece in connection to libraries and fundraising was really a fun thing. After helping some of the other consultants, ended up running some capital campaigns in Utah with you in Fargo, North Dakota, and then some other places.
So yes, I remember our time in Fargo very well.
All over the country doing this ever since 2001.
So what is it about fundraising for libraries that's, say, different than raising money for a church or a theater group or some other kind of nonprofit organization?
Well, there's several things, but the primary thing is that libraries are tax-supported entities of some sort, you know, and that, you know, a lot of times, if there hasn't been a culture of philanthropy created and cultivated around the library, folks' initial reaction is, you know, I already support the library through my taxes. Why would I give to it? Now, we've had a history of friends organizations across the country, but that's always been sort of a smallish gift thing. It hasn't really been a major gift operation. And, you know, library foundations have popped up across the country to build endowment, raise money for special projects. And part of that is just to sort of change that culture, change the perception, and get past the, you know, it's a tax-supported entity. One of the things, you know, that we say is if we can develop that culture and start attracting major gifts, you know, tax dollars give you a good library, but it's the private philanthropic support that can give you a great library.
So that's kind of the answer to that question, then. If someone says, why support a library with your fundraising, it is that the tax dollars will give you a good library, but the fundraising gives you a great library. So I like that. I like that phrase.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, and as we know, especially over the, you know, the last several years, the economy is not always certain. Mm-hmm. You know, the only thing that is certain is that it's going to, you know, fluctuate quite a bit.
Right.
And depending on the funding mechanism for all the various libraries that are across the country, there's been some, you know, pain associated with that economic change. So to the extent we can start positioning the libraries as philanthropic opportunities, we can do a whole lot more, and that's really the point.
So what are some of the most common mistakes that you see when it comes to fundraising?
You know, I think there's two primary ones that I find, and one is too narrow a focus. So a lot of times there would have been, you know, like we had said, a friends group that had sort of the entry point gift thing, you know, sort of a membership organization, and then a foundation was created, sometimes at the impetus of a capital campaign, sometimes just because of the vision of either library leadership or folks in the community. But then oftentimes the focus is a little too narrow, and they'll either be, you know, well, we just were created for this capital effort, or we're just focused on endowment. I just spoke with a library whose foundation is focused on endowment, and that is all they are focused on. So it's a pretty steep hill. So we've already talked about how we need to create a culture of giving around the library, and we already know that folks push back a little bit, especially in the major gift realm. And I'm talking about how do we get, you know, not just $100 out of somebody, but $10,000, $100,000, and $1 million, and $5 million. That's what we're talking about. You know, things that really make a difference. And, you know, just to do that, you know, I think we need to make sure we don't have so narrow of focus. Sometimes a special project can be just the thing to bring a donor in to see that the library maybe isn't the library that they remember from their childhood, is doing even better things now, and it'll create an opportunity later for that person who may not have been a prospect for the endowment to then be one because they see, you know, that the library's been responsive to changing needs and changing times and is still having great outcomes. So that's the first. And then the only other thing I see is This is going to sound harsh, is a program meddling. You know, so, you know, I feel like most libraries, you know, have professional leadership. They got library directors. There's all these folks running around with library degrees, and they know their business. So what's less helpful is when you have a foundation board or any fundraising arm for a library who thinks they know better than the professional staff around, you know, programming objectives.
Right, and that can really get you off mission if you're a library. If someone's coming in and coming up with program ideas that are not consistent with the overall strategic plan or vision of the library.
Right, because that's actually the sweet spot. The sweet spot is, what's the library's vision, and how do we connect a donor's passion to that? Not how can we let donor's passion change the library's vision? So, you know, the sweet spot is making them join and making it occur in a natural way. So that's that. So I'd say too narrow of a focus and too much programmatic meddling.
Sure, I understand. So let's shift gears here a little bit and talk about the role of the fundraising consultant. If, say, you're thinking about, as a library, hiring a consultant to assist you with fundraising, what are the things that you should look for when hiring a consultant? And I guess going along with that, what are some of the things you should look out for when hiring a consultant?
Well, I think, especially in the library field, you know, everything's specialized nowadays. So I think you want a consultant that understands libraries, that pays attention to what's going on in the world. So if you're talking to a consultant now who doesn't understand sort of what's happened in the last, even recent past, with makerspaces and both sort of the good and the bad of that, that doesn't understand why we would have, you know, imaginative children's spaces, who wouldn't even understand, you know, why we would have a teen space and what the role of gaming is, perhaps, in that, and or not, and all the issues. So, I think you got to have an understanding of that, as well as how to relate to donors. So I think you're looking for somebody with that. I think the thing I run into the most, other than somebody who doesn't really understand libraries, you know, again, don't think that's a good fit for a library consultant, fundraising consultant, would be somebody who says, you know, I've got all these connections in town. There's a lot of consultants that sort of peddle on their, you know, I've got all these donors in my back pocket. And I think, you know, a lot, even some of the larger fundraising operations across the country would tell you that's, there's a lot of diminishing returns with that, and it's a lot of smoke and mirrors. So a lot of folks, if the second somebody promises you that they can deliver a donor, a local donor, that's probably the second that you need to be running away. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, this whole effort is so that there's community relationships with you, the library, not with the consultant. So,
right.
So I think that's probably the biggest red flag.
Okay. Give us a story, David. I'm sure you've dealt with a lot of different donors, and they all have their eccentricity, shall we say. So I'd like to hear a little bit about some of your more interesting experiences dealing with potential donors.
Well, one of the sort of earliest on in my experience stories actually happened in the context of work you and I did together, and it was in Fargo, North Dakota. So we had a physician who ran a clinic that was related to some drug testing and things, and there was lots of universities around, and no one had ever been able to get to this guy. Like, so he had not been overtly charitable in any way, but seemed like a charitable guy. Just nobody had gotten to him, so nobody had their hooks in him. He had actually approached the library in the past, offering some Western prints and some things, and or some help with some Western prints that had been donated to the library.
Yeah, we had a collection of prints that he was going to restore for us.
And, right.
That was kind of how we first came to our attention.
Right, and because you had actually handled that well and been responsive to him, he took the meeting when we did our first feasibility study there. I call them charitable interest assessments when we were studying for a capital campaign. So he took the interview, and then that interview turned into a follow-up, you know, three-hour tour of his facility, and then within a week of that, there's $1 million commitment to the capital project. So it just kind of goes to show that you don't, you know, the guy who's saying, hey, I'll help you, you know, work on the archive and the artistic saving of these works could actually turn into $1 million donor for something else.
Right. And I think it's important to point out, you have to look outside the usual suspects. You can't always go back to the same well. You need to try to broaden that pool of people that could possibly donate or support the library.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So let's go through that donor process a little bit. How do you go from somebody being just a prospect, or maybe not even a prospect, maybe I should say a suspect, to actually being a donor? Could you just kind of walk us through the stages of that process?
Yeah, I do. And with a lot of my clients on our foundation boards, I usually tell them, you know, individually, when I'm with an individual board member, I'm like, we just need one. So I think part of the problem is a lot of times we paint this really large picture, and we have this, you know, large number of asks that a person has to make, or large number of contacts. And I want that ultimately. But if you just kind of could break it down first and just say, okay, in the next quarter, I need you to introduce us to three people. And if you've got everybody in your board actually doing that, I think that's a sweet spot that a lot of organizations would like, if their board members are introducing them to, you know, three people a quarter. And I kind of walk through, this sounds a little silly because I call it AAA, and this is how do you rank prospects. And it's really, I just need somebody who has ability to give, who has an affinity to our mission or some, you know, project that we're working on, and then somebody that we have access to. And to the extent we get all three of those in a prospect, that's how we prioritize who we're going to talk to. So if I don't have access, or if I don't have good, you know, sort of intelligence on whether there's ability to give, or if we or think that they're shaky, or, you know that their affinity lies elsewhere, why would we waste time? So a lot of times people get hung up on sort of the usual suspects in a community, and that's not nearly as important as the right suspects. So we don't want the usual suspects, we want the right suspects. And I think if we kind of walk through ability, affinity, and access, we can get there.
If I could stop you right there for just a second. So let's go through that. So it's, you call it the AAA process.
Right.
And it's ability
to give.
Affinity
to your mission or project.
And accessibility. Meaning you have to be able to get in.
You can get the appointment.
Yeah. Okay, great.
And that's the key. So there's a lot of complicated formulas on how you kind of prioritize prospects that you're going to go after. But, yeah, I think it can be a little, you know, I'm always about how can we make this simple? Because I need this volunteer to actually do something, not just talk about doing something. Right. So this is the process I walk through with folks.
So how would you say that the donor landscape has changed over the last 10 years or so? What's different about it than it was a few years ago?
Yeah, I think part of this change that I'm going to talk about is probably been occasioned by the economic uncertainty. So, you know, we see the folks still have given, and the wealthy folks and not so wealthy folks have continued to give in spite of economic downturns. But we've seen some organizations haven't received the same level of funding that they have in the past. And I think what's really happening, it used to be that you just asked somebody for money, whether, you know, at whatever level, and you would tend to get it. And there didn't have to be a whole lot of, you know, purpose around what the money was for. And I think what we've seen now is that special project fundraising is the key. And it's because folks really are tuned into outcomes. So they don't really want to know what you're doing and what you're going to fund so much as what happens when you do it. So I think in the past, we could just talk about outputs, what we do. But now we have to focus more on outcomes, what happens when we do it. And folks really want to know that there's going to be a return, you know, for their charitable investment. So I think that's the key. And that's probably the organizations that survived economic downturns and uncertainty were the ones that still positioned the outcomes that they were driving in their community. And that's the same for libraries versus just the outputs, which really goes, you know, instead of just saying we need money, it's really showing the vision about if you give us money, this is what we're going to do.
These are the positive things.
And this is the result that's going to happen.
Right.
You know, I think that's the biggest thing.
What is it about libraries overall that you think makes them a good fit for philanthropy? I mean, we've all heard the quote from Carnegie about, I can't imagine, you know, better philanthropy than
libraries. Yeah, he actually said libraries are the best kind of philanthropy, and I'm willing to stake my reputation on that.
Thank you very much.
And he did across the country with lots of buildings that started.
So what is it you think about the library that does make it, that attracts somebody like a Carnegie or has attracted all of these other donors over many decades? What makes them a good philanthropic opportunity?
Yeah, I think what's there's sort of the personal side where a lot of folks have a love of reading and a love of education. So there is a lot of affinity that's sort of built into libraries after you start unpacking that it is a charitable opportunity. But I think what happens, this goes back to outcomes and sort of who all we touch. It's really hard to think of another community organization that touches as many people or has the potential to touch as many people as the public library. It's sort of all ages, all stations in life. Now, you know, what else does that in a community? Well, hospitals do, but there's still some people that are like healthy for life, and they, you know, but, and libraries sort of just fill this place that can serve everybody sort of regardless of station. It creates, you know, a third place. We've been talking about that in the library world for less 15 years. And, you know, where else can that be? You know, some folks need something other than work and home, and, you know, the library fulfills that. There's this sense of community, and I think that's it. So what else can you give to that is a gift to everybody? Public library.
Absolutely. Now, we've talked about the process of philanthropy and securing the donor and all of those steps. But, you know, the job doesn't end once you secure the donation. If you could just talk a little to us about sort of the care and feeding of donors. What should happen after you secure that gift?
Yeah, and this we call this donor stewardship, and this is really, you know, once a donor has, you know, become a stakeholder with you and supported a project, supported the library, given to your foundation for some work, certainly if they have given to an endowment or have indicated that there's an estate gift, you want to make sure that is celebrated, and that is all done through communication and invitation. So you have to be thinking about, how can I get stories back to them? That's the communication part. And the more I can tie it to an outcome that came from their gift, the better. And then how can I invite them to actually then see that sometimes? So we actually just had a great story here in Gwinnett County, where we had a donor that funded an early childhood literacy program. And there's some free books that go out to kids in under-resourced areas, Ready, Set, Read. And we had a story where mom said, you know, my child got this book. It's the first book that this child's actually owned on his own. And he's been sleeping with this book ever since he got it. So, I mean, this is really, this is where, what, $2 and a quarter is going to, like, change this kid's life forever. Like, where else can you do that? This is where you can do that. But making sure that the donor knows that, and then to the extent there's ever, you know, a gathering that makes sense to invite them to actually start seeing that. That's the thing. So communication and invitation are what I think you have to just keep in mind as you roll forward.
Well, thank you, David. And we're very excited about the Ready, Set, Read program. It's going great guns. So we're looking forward to good things from that in the future as well. Now, a lot of libraries may say, you know, I really need enhancements to my operating fund. I need more money for day-to-day operations. Is there a way that I can raise money to accomplish that?
Kind of. So, yes-ish. Is that an answer? So I am a lawyer, so I reserve the right to sort of...
Yes, it's definitely a lawyerly response.
It's a lawyer response. Maybe not the ish part. I think the key to that is still special projects. So we just talked about Ready, Set, Read. So that actually had some capital piece. So we were going to buy some extra books that we were going to give away.
Right.
But at the same time, just like the mechanics of that, the promotion of that, the marking of that, and the staff of that, we needed to cover that cost. And it was a donor that stepped up to do that. So so that did augment operating budget, but it did it in the context of a special project.
So if I'm hearing you right, what you're saying is, yes, if you can tie that, it's best to go for a special project funding, but you incorporate some of those operational costs into your request. So it helps support and enhance your operational fund in an indirect way.
Exactly. So you end up still being able to do more than you would have been able to do without that funding. And I think, again, to the extent you can create a culture of giving around the library, then I think you earn the right to start, you know, even just raising sort of annual fund dollars for operations or, you know, collection enhancement money or engaging spaces type money. So I think you can start doing that, but you have to start the conversation somewhere if it hasn't been started.
Mm-hmm. And easier to do that with a special project rather than some vague, open-ended commitment to an endowment or to growing your library operationally.
I think that's what I've seen that, you know, across numerous states. It's much easier to invite somebody into a conversation around a special project that has, you know, obvious skin and obvious outcomes, and then from there we can ask for the next thing. So.
Not every library in Georgia, and I'm sure this is true in other states as well, has the resources to hire a consultant like you to help them with their fundraising needs. So what would be your advice to some of the smaller library systems that maybe don't have the money to hire a consultant on their own?
Well, I think in the end of the day, it still just has to be something that they prioritize, and they have to start somewhere. So it doesn't have to be this ongoing monthly thing. You know, that can be helpful. There's some discipline to the order of having somebody show up and expect certain things to be done and be helping you get certain things done. But there's also other things we can do. There could be a retreat where either the library board or the library foundation or those two boards together could talk about giving. You could also have some sort of an audit related to the efforts of the organization around fundraising if there's been some sort of organized effort. And you can also do a charitable interest assessment. That's, you know, a lot of times that's called a feasibility study. I think charitable interest assessment is probably a little more honest. And just start having the conversation about whether there is an appetite or whether one could be fanned and growing the flames around that charitable appetite for supporting the library. And I think just even starting the conversation is important, and that helps you know what you can do. So I think you still have to just start somewhere, and it may be that you know a director has to find some special funding from a community partner or a donor in town that says, you know, we'd like to do some things related to fundraising, related to capacity building, and you know bring that in just for, again, for a retreat, for an audit, for some sort of study.
I think it's important, too, to note that even though you may be in a small community, that everything's scalable. So, I mean, $5,000 or $10,000 for your library might be a significant gift that allows you to do something that you otherwise couldn't have done, regardless of the size of the community that you're in. So you shouldn't really be put off just by the fact that you might be in a smaller community.
Right. I definitely think that's the case. Could definitely move forward, I think, sort of regardless of the size of the community.
Any final tips or pointers for us? Anything else that you want to add?
You know, I think from just the encouragement to get started, I believe that there's sort of pent up, you know, willingness to support the things that go on inside libraries, especially as libraries move into new frontiers related to whether it's, you know, career online high school and having, you know, diplomas, high school diplomas for folks, to makerspaces, to all of the things that are going on in libraries across the country. There's a lot of appeal. There's a lot of best kept secret too. So a lot of folks, I think the average person in the community may not know all of the good things that are going on inside the library. So if you can just start these conversations, it only ends positively. So.
And one last thing, website. What's your website address?
Oh, it's givingdesign.com. So givingdesign.com. And
so if people want more information, they can go there. And they can
find me.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you very much, David. We appreciate your taking the time to talk to us today. And it's very informative. We are hoping, of course, both of us, for the continued growth and success here in Gwinnett. But thanks again for taking the time for this podcast.
Thanks for this chance.